Thanks, Steve. Emma from ABC. Good morning, Emma Haskin with you on Desert Tracks. I'm sitting in a popular cafe and across from me is my next guest. Let me introduce you to Steve Schwartz, who has been in Central Australia, well, in the Northern Territory since 1977, and he can now add author to his long resume. The book is called Broken Pot, The Making of the Walpree Bible, and it's just been published. We'll find out more about that imminently, but first, it's a very good morning to Steve. Thanks so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. Pleasure to be here.
Steve, let's go back to small town Ohio in the United States, where you are the youngest of four children. Can you describe what life was like growing up for you?
I was born in 1951, so I graduated high school in 1969, and in many ways it was sort of like the Happy Days program. No big deal, had good friends, small town America. My dad was a barber, wife was a housemaker, homemaker. I was the youngest one, my older brother David, 5 years older, was the only one that I actually lived at home while I was there. My older brother Buster and sister Sandra had long gone. So yeah, you go to school for 9 months of the year. The summers we rammed around with my neighborhood gang, played baseball, softball, went swimming, that sort of thing. Wintertime comes, you'd go sledding occasion. We lived on Union Street. Our house wasn't particularly big, mid-size, but then about four or five houses down, there were some more mansion-like larger ones, and they had a long driveway. And it would take me about an hour, hour and a half to shovel it after a snowstorm, and for which I got the princely sum of $2, which was, a fortune in those days. You could get a lot for $2.
And what did you spend it on?
I would save it. I had a little 10-cent dime bank holder that my parents, I'm sure they were the ones that made sure that I got that, but I'd spend it on soft drink, soda pop, baseball cards, comic books.
Sounds like a little boy's dream.
Yeah, yeah.
So tell me a little bit about what the relationship was like with your parents, given that your two older siblings had already left.
Overall, I think it was a good relationship. My father was Harry Keenan. We did quite a few things together during basketball and football seasons. For our Fostoria High School, we would go to virtually every football game and basketball game and so on. Those, being a small town, that was one of the focal points of activity. Everybody supported either Fostoria High School or the St. Wendland's, which was the Catholic school in town. So those were big affairs. My dad, he was a member of the Gideons, which is a international Christian organization whose purpose is to distribute Bibles.
And how important would you say that faith was to your father?
Well, I think it was very important to him. He was an alcoholic. His father was an alcoholic. Dad always told me that his family did fairly well. They were contractors, and they would bid on small county building projects like bridges and so on. He was a gambler. He was a card sharp. He could count cards. He always told me that if he hadn't gambled and drank so much during the Depression, that the family wouldn't have lost its business. They lost control. It went bankrupt.
So your elder siblings would have been alive during the Depression. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
That must have been a really tough and challenging time then for your parents, in terms of, given that he may have been drinking during that time and gambling, mm-hmm. and also having three mouths, including his own, four mouths to feed.
Yeah, well, he went to barber school in the early 30s. You know, he's told the story about how they learned to shave men with cutthroat or straight razors by lathering up a balloon and shaving the balloon. And if it popped, that was an immediate fail, obviously. My oldest sister, Sandra, was born in 1936, my brother in 1938. He had a religious experience, a conversion to Christianity, to the Lord Jesus, in 1945, and gave up his drinking immediately on the spot.
Did he ever talk about that moment? Because really, it has had an effect on you, hasn't it?
Well, it has, and he wasn't the only one in the church. We went to a small church, a Bethel Evangelical United Church, And there were several of the men, Louis Kovacs and Dale French. Dale, I believe, drove a beer truck. And, you know, it was a conservative, evangelical, even fundamentalist church. And Wednesday nights or Sunday nights, there'd be testimony time where you got up and you said what the Lord's been doing with you that week. And on more than one occasion, you know, Dale would get up and just, you know, with tears in his eyes, talk about how he had been saved from life of drinking and driving a beer truck and so on. And so these were people who had major lifestyle changes that they attributed to their faith and so on.
So how did that faith then influence your upbringing?
I guess it influenced my upbringing in that the church was probably the focal point of our whole family's week, social life, life in general, and so on. We always attended Sunday morning service, Sunday school at 9, church at 10. Services lasted out at 11, and then Sunday evening service at starting 7:30 to 8:30, and Wednesday night prayer meeting, as they were called. And so that schedule, from the time that earliest memories until I left home to go to university in 1969, well, that was the schedule. The whole week revolved around that.
Did you ever question that lifestyle?
I was probably a quiet rebeller. because my dad being my dad, you needed to be very careful as to how much open rebellion.
What would happen? Engage.
Well, he would, as I say, he was a reformed alcoholic, and even though I never saw him take a drink, he never did. I think he would have still carried over some of the behaviors of an alcoholic, somewhat unpredictable in his moods, most of the time pleasant, but then all of a sudden I would do something that, you know, making a noise inappropriately in church or back talking just a little bit too much, and then received not a few sound spankings, let's put it that way. Yeah, it was a spare the rod, spoil the child type upbringing.
And how was your relationship with your mother?
Very warm. She was, you know, wonderful, you know, good mom, more than good. She very gentle. I can't
was
remember.
Was she your safe place, do you think?
She probably was. I remember one time Dad and I were coming home from a basketball game locally, and I don't know what I'd done, but he had made it very clear that when we were getting at home, I was going to get a thrashing. And I remember leaping out of the car, charging into the house, and throwing myself around my mother's legs. Now, whether she was able to calm my dad down and whether I got the spanking at that point, I can't remember. But yeah, she was just a loving person. I never heard her, hardly ever raised her voice. You know, the strongest thing that I think I ever heard her say to Dad was, "Oh, Harry," you know.
And she must have had a bit of a tough time on her hands, given that you said that there wasn't a lot of money around. She'd come through the Depression. How did she feed everyone?
Well, she was very creative. She was just a master of creating very tasty meals on a very limited budget, I think. And then, my dad during the 1960s, before the Beatles' hairstyle ruined the barber business. I haven't really forgiven the Beatles for that.
But can you lay sole blame on the Beatles for that, do you think?
Well, enough so. After 1964, everybody started getting, you know, Mo Howard haircuts, and he never made more than $100 a week. Mm. And I think her budget, he would come home probably at about 7 o'clock after working 5.5 days a week, and he would get his money, and he would sit at his little desk, and he had an accounts book and so on, and mom would get her $20, and that was the household money for that week.
Can you give us some examples, insight into what was on the dinner plate?
One of the favorites, it was called Under the Sea Jello. So you'd have lime jelly, and she would take half of that, and she would whip it up with cream cheese, so it was kind of this lime-colored layer, and so you'd have a layer of fruit, and then the regular jelly, and then you had this layer of the cream cheese stuff over the top, and that was one of my favorites. She was great at cooking chickens. My dad was a very small man. He only weighed 105 pounds when he was in high school. But anyways, he was a prodigious eater. He would eat very slowly, but for a long time, he could eat a chicken and a half by himself with no problem. he was not in a hurry, but he, yeah. And she made lots of good stuff, green beans with mushroom sauce on it, and fried liver and onions. I see you making it. I haven't had fried liver and onions in a long time. I think I've probably lost my, but yeah, she could make something like that very tasty.
You went through primary school, you went to high school. What did you then decide that you wanted to do after high school?
I did very well at school. I was always in the top, basically top 1 or 2% all the way through. And I knew I was going to go to university, college as they call it there. In high school we had guidance class, and so you had to put down three things that you might want to be and investigate. And I think one was a dentist, another one is... was a clergyman, is that was called, it wasn't called a minister, a preacher, it was called a clergyman. So I thought, okay, well, and there was always sort of the expectation with my pastor of my church and my parents that I was going to be, you know, I would do something like that. I can't remember whether I put down missionaries. I only had vague ideas of what missionaries did, except go overseas and show up every 4 or 5 years and show slides.
But there is an element of truth in that, isn't there? That's, you did become a missionary.
Yeah, yeah. I went to a small Christian liberal arts college in Huntington, Indiana, which is a 4-hour drive west of Fostoria. There were only about 600 students at the time. I ended up majoring in philosophy. I did a course, and I thought, oh, this is quite interesting. My philosophy professor, Dr. Bill Hasker, was 6'8", and... it was very, yeah, he had strange mannerisms. He was sort of tall and gangly, and he would, when he cleared his throat, everybody knew it. But he was a very brilliant thinker, and I just ended up taking about 7 or 8 courses with him.
What resonated with you when it came to studying philosophy?
Just the ideas and how they developed and so on. They did a... yeah, I guess just the thinking about thinking and looking at the world and trying to put that with a whole range of philosophers within, say, a Christian context and how it relates and so on, and how our ideas, our presuppositions affect our attitudes, the way we live and so on.
And is that where you met your wife?
That's where I met my wife, yes. She was 2 years behind me. I graduated in 73, she graduated in 75. That's probably one of the more interesting stories in the book. I don't know whether I should give it away now.
No. Give us a bit of a teaser.
Well, it was my junior year, or third year, and I had long since broken up with my high school sweetheart. And there was this blonde, long-haired blonde, caught my eye, and there were probably several. And I asked somebody, well, what's her name? And they told me Bev Mote. And so these were separate male-female dorms, and so Livingston Hall, where my wife had sort of a buzzer system, a Morse code buzzer system. You'd go there, and I don't know, 50, 60 girls, and it DDD, and that they would know, oh, somebody's there, wants me. So I go there, and I'm getting ready to invite her to see if she wanted to go to the Friday night pictures with me, and so I buzz her, and out comes a blonde. And I thought it was Bev Mote, but it wasn't the girl that I had in mind. And so I sort of looked blankly at her, and I asked her. I was still outside the door, and she was sort of up on a landing inside. And I said, well, I'd like to speak to Bev Mote. And she says, well, I'm Bev Mote. And I got even more confused at that at that stage. And she says, well, maybe you want to see my roommate. So she went back and got her roommate, who was probably about twice her size. And I said, just forget it. And I basically, as Bev related, I became the general laughingstock of all the women and the girls.
And you finally found her.
A year later. A year later, she was working at the snack bar in the school cafeteria they had, and a snack bar, and she worked there, and it was slow there. And I noticed that she was sitting there with the Philosophy 1 textbook open. I thought, oh, here we go. So I said, you know, how are you doing there with that? And she said, oh, this is really hard. So, you know, I took the opportunity then to barge in with my knowledge of philosophers and philosophy, and I helped her get an A in that course. and the rest is history.
We probably should talk about your first track here in Desert Tracks this morning. Which one are we going to go with first?
Those Were the Days by Mary Hopkins. Yes, that was favorite. Well, again, you started off saying, well, how was it? And I look back at that, my growing up, the 50s and the 60s were a nostalgic time, and those were the days, but they were also the days that were leading into Vietnam and the general disaster that that turned into for America and much of the world. And, you know, that song is just very nostalgic, and I suppose America at that time was probably somewhat different than the America today. We were pretty, as Americans, we were probably pretty sure that we were world beaters and could do anything. Okay, 69 put a man on the moon, and so on. But if there was that sense of general optimism that, again, Vietnam and subsequent years, oil shocks in the mid-70s kind of put the brakes on that, I guess, the American spirit, which isn't dead. But, yeah, and so that song was just brings back nostalgia for me.
Let's have a listen. Here is Those Were the Days, Mary Hopkin, here on Desert Tracks.
Once upon a time, there was a tavern where we used to raise a glass or two. Remember how we laughed away the hours? Think of all the great things we would do. Those were the days, my friend, we thought they'd never.
That was Those Were the Days, Mary Hopkin. You're with me, Emma Haskin, on Desert Tracks. My guest this morning is Steve Schwartz. He and his wife came to Australia back in 1977 from the United States of America. You may be familiar with Steve's voice. He has been working at the ABC every now and again through the translator service to translate our main top stories into Walpri. But he has since retired, roughly about a year ago. Let's go back to coming to Australia in 1977. What made you make that decision?
Well, we were training as missionaries, and eventually it came time for us to meet together with the assignments committee. And the group that we worked with, Wycliffe Bible Translators and its sister organization, the Summer Institute of Linguistics, at the time there were estimated somewhat over 2,000 languages around the world that did not have written languages, didn't have alphabets, didn't have the Bible any of the Bible translated in their language, and that was the raison d'etre for the organization. I had had a couple years of high school French. My wife had a couple years of Spanish, but we certainly weren't fluent. And there are many countries where, if we had gone to that, we would have to have spent a year or more learning the national language. And we didn't really want to do that, so we had thought about working in northern Canada or Alaska among the Inuit. We could have gone to Papua New Guinea, who English is not the national language, but Tokbisan. And then we decided, well, we might go to Australia. We think English is the national language there, and to work among the Aboriginal people about whom we knew very little.
And not just any part of Australia, but La Jemano.
Yeah.
It's extraordinarily isolated, and back in the 70s it would have been even more isolated.
Yeah, even more so. Yeah, there was paved road from Darwin to Catherine, and then maybe for, I think, was single lane or lane and a half of semi-paved road going to the west, and then once you turned south, past Top Springs and past Wave Hill and so on, particularly the last 110 kilometers from Wave Hill into Hooker Creek, as it was known at the time, it was very much unpaved and sometimes with huge washouts in the road and so on. And so nobody had cell phones and so on. So, yeah, it was with much more fear and trepidation that we made our first road journeys there, because you just didn't have the facilities and so on if you had breakdowns and so on. Quite different than traveling in the States.
Your sole purpose was to go there to learn Walpri and to translate the Bible.
Yep.
How accepting were the community of that purpose that you had?
They were very accepting. We followed on from another couple, Lothar and Elsie Jacks, who were from Germany, and they had begun work there and built the house where we eventually lived in. They arrived there in, I think, 1968. And Lothar was, he was a jack of all trades, could fix cars and whatever, apart from being quite a brilliant linguist and so on. And he was making strides, early strides in the language. He helped devise the alphabet and was working with, done some very early translation work, and unfortunately died of a heart attack while on a hunting trip with one of the Walbury men up in the top end somewhere. And so Els, who had four children, was basically too busy and raising their family to be able to continue on with the work there. So
were you prepared?
Well, not nearly as prepared as what I thought. I mean, I had, after graduating from Huntington College, I did a year of SIL training, linguistic training at a training facility in outside of Dallas. And again, did very well in the grammar courses and the phonology courses and the anthropology literacy courses and so on. But as we learned the various things that we needed to do for linguistic analysis and so on, you usually were given problems on a piece of paper, language problems, and you came back the next day with the answer, and it was always sort of canned linguistics as you worked your way up the things that you needed to know. But when we arrived at La Germano, everything was quite different, not just physically different in terms of the environment and so on. I found that learning Walbury wasn't like canned linguistics. It was much harder. The sociocultural basis of Walbury is much different, completely different than Indo-European languages. And the things that they chose to talk about, which are basically family and kinship oriented, are not the things that we spend all our time talking about. But I didn't make what I had hoped to be the very rapid progress in language learning. It became an increasingly frustrating, almost debilitating effort. The more you struggle, the further behind you got, type of thing.
And what effect did that therefore have on you?
Well, it was probably at about that time that the first signs of depression set in. I started having almost these nightly night terrors. I'd go to sleep, and then I would have a dream, and I would see the hooded death figure with the scythe and the whole bit. And a clock would always be ticking, like a grandfather clock, ticking up the hands towards 12. And I knew in the dream that as soon as it struck 12, I would die. And then at 11:59, I always woke up in a cold terror sweat and laying there, completely exhausted. And this went on for, weeks and months.
Did you talk to Bev about it?
She knew very much about what was happening, because I'd be waking up and, hang on to her almost as a lifeline and so on. And the trouble was, we were isolated at La Germano, which is, 6-7 hour drive from Catherine, 11 from Darwin. You had sisters there, but you didn't have permanent doctors. There were no counselors available except for Ivan Jordan, he and his wife Vera were the Baptist missionaries, so I could share some things with him, but he wasn't a trained counselor or therapist or anything like that, nor were there antidepressant drugs available at the time. So I hadn't been officially diagnosed with depression at that stage.
But you knew that there was something not quite right.
Something was horribly wrong, and there was even some suicidal thoughts that started to creep in.
But you learned Walpree. You did it.
I did it.
How long did it take?
A lifetime.
Are you still learning?
A lifetime, and still learning. Yeah, that's for sure. It's one of those things, when you do translation, there's no such thing as a perfect translation. You translate it. It is what it is. You check it, and you recheck it. Translation wouldn't have been possible if I hadn't been working with, very competent and skilled language speakers.
Is it more interpretation than translation?
It is. It's certainly not. We were taught was known as dynamic equivalent translation. It's not word-for-word translation. It's the same kind of difficulties we had when I worked with the interpreter service and we had to do the ABC News. The interpretations there were not, it wasn't word-for-word, because the language structure is different, the vocabulary is different, and the semantic structure is different, and so you have to make modifications of it in order to get as much meaning through as possible.
And what was your relationship with people in La Germano? Because you would have had to have built almost instant trust.
Well, because of the work of Lothar and Elsie Jacks had been there, they knew that we were the replacement. You know, when we finally got to La Germano, I think in April of 78, I was 25, my wife was 23, our son Caleb was three months old, and we were welcomed. They weren't quite sure what this whole business was about of somebody learning the language in Bible translation because they'd seen so little of it. And I would spend the bulk of my days would be, I'd spend time in my office learning vocabulary and so on, but I'd spend a lot of my time just wandering around town, bullying up whoever I could that wanted to talk with me. There was a blind woman, Maggie, who sat up in camp, and I always kidded her, says, "Well, you can't see me coming, so you can't get away." But she loved to tell stories and to talk, and she would correct my language.
So it was pure immersion.
Yeah, it was pure immersion. You couldn't do it. There wasn't a Berlitz course in Walmart.
And how long were you there for?
We were there from 1978 to 1986. We first went there, men's ceremonial camp basically operated year-round. The initiation and that whole thing would last months at a time, whereas now it's sort of compressed in a much shorter period of time.
You mentioned that there was that inkling of depression early on in your shift to La Germano. Did that snowball?
It did snowball. As I say, it started to develop into suicidal ideation, suicidal thoughts. We visited some friends, the McNairs, who were translators at Wave Hill among the Gurindji people, and one night we were staying there. I got up in the middle of the night, and I walked about a kilometer to the Victoria River. There was a big bridge that goes over the Victoria River, and I had my dog Tigger with me, and it was probably about 2 in the morning, and I got up and kissed the family goodbye. They were asleep. They didn't know I'd gone. And I just looked over the bridge about, 20, 30 meters down and thought, well, I think I could kill myself here. I didn't. I walked back. And
What stopped you?
Well, I have no idea. Probably the fear of eternal consequences would be one thing. But I guess part of the feeling was, my emotional feeling was feeling trapped. I know that having always been successful and in school and so on, to admit defeat, admit that you had tried something and this hadn't worked out and we'd have to go back to the States and basically admit failure, that was me admitting failure. Bev never failed.
But do you think you had failed? It sounds like you were pretty successful.
Well, I thought I was failing. I'm here. I'm stuffing up this job. I'm not moving ahead. I'm not making progress. I had no idea that it would be this hard. And I'm sure that I was making it. It's one of those deals. The harder you make it, the harder you make it. It just snowballs. And
when did you get help?
Finally, got the first bit of help probably in about October 1986, we were back on furlough. I had started a master's degree program, but I had gotten a block, a writing mental block, trying to get the thesis down. And again, it was September 30th of 1986. I was once again staring at a blank computer. And
hi, Emma here. We are just going to hit pause on Steve's story this morning. He goes on to describe another attempt. If this raises any concerns for you, Lifeline's number is 13 11 14 and Beyond Blue is 1-800-512-348. Let's rejoin Steve's story on Desert Tracks this morning with his wife, Bev, coming to his aid.
Bev came home and found me, and by that stage I was a blubbering mess, and they got me to the hospital. And then fortunately there was a Pine Rest Christian Hospital, which was a very wonderful sanctuary for troubled souls. And so I spent a month there trying to put wheels back on and talking through things. And again, there's very little in the way of medicine or antidepressants. I think I got a couple pills right at the beginning just to knock me out. But beyond that, it was just various talking therapies and group activities and so on. And
did you put anything back to your story of origin, your family? Was that ever brought up in these counseling sessions?
Well, it was, and then, I guess I spent a little bit more time thinking about, well, how am I like my dad, and how am I different? What am I doing that he did that could have been done better or shouldn't have been done at all, type of thing? And so, yeah, there was a lot of introspection and then strategies set in place so that you know, I could not get into these destructive thought cycles and so on.
And you came back to Australia?
2.5 years later, we came back to Australia. We spent a year and a half down in Dallas back at the SIL school where I was helping to teach translation principles, but also finishing my master's degree, which I did finish it after much consultation with the mission superiors and so on, because they, you know, there's always a risk sending somebody who's attempted suicide back there. You know, the first sign of any trouble, when we would probably be pulled. It was decided that we wouldn't and couldn't go back and live at Los Hermanos, so that's when we shifted here to Alice Springs. We lived out at St. Mary's Children Village, in a lovely spot right by the river. I was doing the same work, and I was working. There are plenty of Walburys in town here and from Yundamu and so on, so I would travel out and work with local women. The thing that I think that probably helped the most in one area in terms of mental health was the fact that I was finally able to start churning out some translation. Was brought in contact with some wonderful, fully literate Walbury women, Teresa Ross, Christine Spencer, and a few, Connie Wallet, who's now passed away, and I would be able to work with them, give them written drafts of what I call front translations, modified English translations. They would call me when their translations were done, and so we had a system, and it was able to churn out. I was able to start doing the job.
Did the mental health issues rear up again?
They did rear up. We finished the Walbury Bible. It's not a complete, it's a full New Testament, 12% of the Old Testament. That was dedicated in 2001. One day I was getting ready to, getting some chapters of 1 Samuel ready to translate, and I just sat up in my chair and thought, you know, that's it. If I don't quit now, I'll never quit. And so I decided to stop at that stage, just because the rest of the Old Testament was too big, and it remains too big.
What do you mean? What does that mean?
Well, I guess I was just tired of doing translation. I was 23 years at that stage.
23 years?
23 years to get to that point, and it was just sort of, after the Bible dedication, I suppose it was a bit like the deflated balloon.
Fair enough, don't you think?
Well, yeah, that's right, and a friend later told me, he said, you know, what did you come to Australia to do? I said, well, translate the scripture. What did you do? I translated the scripture. So he said, your job is done. Part of it was self-acceptance and realizing that you had done what God had called us to do. And so it was finished to that extent.
We need to talk about your final track here on Desert Tracks this morning. It is Anthem, Leonard Cohen.
Yes.
He plays a role in your memoir as well, doesn't he?
All through it. I was probably introduced to Leonard Cohen 20 years ago. He's now deceased. He passed away a couple years ago. So in terms of his thoughts, he's sort of a strange amalgam of Christian, Judaistic, Zen Buddhism thinking and so on. And over the years, his voice mellowed. It just deepened and so on. And the things that he writes, I think he's one of the greatest poets of the 20th century. It's kind of demeaning to call him a songwriter.
So why have you chosen this particular track?
Well, it's because it contains some wonderful words in there. It says, ring the bell that still can ring. And I get choked up just thinking about it. Forget your perfect offering. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets through. And that's just sort of the way it is. Whether it's God or whatever your religious things are, if you think it's about you and your abilities and whatever it is you're doing, you're wrong. You're probably going to have to be cracked open a little bit until what is in there can come out and what needs to get in gets in. And he speaks of that sense of longing and just profound thinking and religiosity. I just think he's wonderful.
Thank you so much for your time this morning. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The birds, they sing at the break of day. Start again, I heard them say. has passed away, or what is yet to be. Yeah, the war